a second.
Okay.
Let me start this over. Okay. So attendance is George Dunkel, Chase Christensen, Karen Kessie, Chris Augieri, Margaret's iPad, Carolyn Lobdell, Amanda Hoyt, Gary Wheeler, Jeff, and Robert Hostetler, who I'm assuming lost service. He's still in there.
Okay.
So he said, I can hear you. Thanks for starting. Okay. So that was from Rob. So what I'll do is I'll go ahead and I'm going to share the agenda. And then if we can get a motion to approve and a second to vote.
Yeah, I'll call the meeting to order and entertain a motion.
Motion to approve the agenda is presented.
Second.
Thank you. Let's vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. So the motion passes. If Rob texts you that he votes yes, I suppose that's fine. But yes, the motion passes.
Aye. Sorry about that, Karen.
Oh, there you go. Thanks. Okay, so that's five. Thanks, Rob. So we're going to go ahead and get started. George, would you like to introduce yourself and what we're doing tonight? Our meeting is going to go for until 7:30. And so we have time with George tonight, and this fulfills our goal of having board training annually. And we discussed this idea recently at our monthly board meeting in April to, you know, realizing that three of our board members and our general manager have not been through this training. So George, why don't you take it away?
All right. Well, thanks, Karen. Well, good evening. I think a lot of you know me. My name is George Dunkel. I'm with Special District Association of Oregon. I'm retired out of the fire service, and I'm happy to tell you I live in the West Hills of Scappoose, so I'm not in the drainage district, but I can see it from where I live. So appreciate what you do. I did do a dike drive the other day with my 15-year-old grandson, and we made it. So I drove by your facility, Chase. I thought of you when I went by. You would have noticed the white knuckles. To get this started, I appreciate what Karen had to say. You're kind of fortunate, and we don't do a lot of these for individual districts. We try to do these regionally, and especially in odd years like this. We'll be going around the state here in August and September. For a lot of you, that's a difficult time of the year. So when Karen reached out to me and Chase, I said, you bet. I get to sit in my own home and work with one of my own providers. I appreciate it. So we're here to do that for you. Our class does normally run about 70 to 90 minutes, depending on questions. I did shorten yours up a little bit. That's why you got a late handout from me, because not that I took any material stuff out of there. I just took out some of the advertising slides, so I don't have to talk about that stuff, if that makes sense. Please understand that I am a practitioner. I'm retired. As I told you, I'm retired out of the fire service. I have been doing this work with local governments for many, many years. I served locally there here in Scappoose on the fire district board for 25 years. I served on SCAO's board. I am a practitioner. I am not an attorney. If you get into some real technical questions about some of this stuff, I'll refer you to the ORS, and in some cases, just refer you to your own local legal counsel. But I don't think we're going to go there today. I pretty much take a practitioner's approach, and you'll probably enjoy it. I do take questions. I worked with Chase a little bit today to understand how this works. And not to throw myself under the bus, but this is the first time doing this type of a presentation, totally sitting by myself looking at walls, instead of having some live audience in front of me that could also be virtual. But I'm hopeful that these pictures I get to see of some of you will keep me focused. So we will take questions. I understand I'm going to get a little light the frame will light up. But if I don't see you right away, please come. If you're not already showing your video, bring your video on so maybe I can see your hand or something. So between Chase and I, we'll make it work. So with that, unless anybody has any questions, you're going to see my screen. Can everybody see it? Perfect. Except I can't move it. So why did that work earlier? Oh, there it is. All right. So today's topics is just, this is kind of the basic, if you think about college courses, the 101 course, We're going to take you through a little bit about what's a district, what kind of authority the district has and the board has to operate the district. We'll do a little entry class on public meetings. We'll review your ethics, Oregon State Ethics Commission rules that really apply to all of us. Even some of them still apply to me as a retired public official. And we'll talk a little bit about what we've seen go well in the state of Oregon with effective boards having expectations for themselves and having expectations for staff. And hopefully we'll be able to answer your questions as we go through this today and at the end. So I've got to move this. I'm going to put this thing maybe like that. Pardon me, but again, this is new. Okay, so we're going to start off with talking about your district as a whole. You guys are a company. I believe you're formed under ORS 554, which makes you a public corporation. That is your principal act. If you think about how your district gets the right to do what it does in the state of Oregon, it's basically been granted those powers by the state. This goes back, to King George. He granted authority to colonies and back then, and it's really just carried over that the federal government grants authority to states. States then turn around and grant authority to local governments. And your authority comes to your principal act, which I believe you're formed under ORS 554. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it is. I was pretty sure it was.
It changed in the late 90s. It was originally something different, but
It was originally 547, and that's why I show them, but now it's under 554, which is actually more effective, in my opinion. So it works well for you. Other statutes also give the district some authority. You have authority to conduct elections. You can grant bonds with a member's approval. You can enter into contracts. There's some administrative rules that could give you some authority that through the different agencies that you work with at the state level. And you could get authority from the city. If the city passed an ordinance, or if you were able to pass an ordinance for some reason, through your rules, that could give the district some additional authority. I don't believe you have any of those in place right now, but that is a way that districts get authority. There's also some implied powers. Even though it may not specifically state it in ORS 554, you have the ability to purchase supplies, to employ staff, to enter into contracts, and do those incidental tasks relating to the exercising of the authority of the district, of the services that you provide. So what's the board do? Where does it get its policy, its authority? Well, it comes from, again, from the district. The enabling legislation says the board has the authority to set policy and give direction for the district. It's supposed to serve at the best interest of the community and its constituents, its members. It develops policy and direction, the board does, through board action. In order to do that, just like you did this evening, you must properly notice and call a public meeting. It requires a quorum to be present. It generally requires approval by majority of the board. So the board can't meet without a quorum. When we get into public meetings, we'll get into that in a little more detail. But the board gets authority by having these things in place. And then all votes must be taken publicly, no secret ballots. I do believe under your articles of incorporation, you do have some ability to have, not secret ballots, but... you can have a person vote for somebody else as long as they have the authority, which most districts do not have that right to do that. What's that called? What did I just forget?
Proxy.
Proxy. Thank you, Chase. You have ability to have some proxies where no other districts have that, or no other type of districts. The board does exercise its authority through two ways. One, if you have the authority as a district to enforce and implement an ordinance, which means a law on the people. Generally, we see that in fire districts and in cities and counties where they actually have a more active role in developing laws on the public. It's a very formal process to pass an ordinance. It's not something that you would take lightly. You would need to have the authority to do that. And I don't know what that would be. I know you have the authority through your development, through your enabling legislation to levy a fee. But I don't know that you actually can do anything else, but you may. And if you do, you can't just do that at one meeting. It goes through an ordinance process and it takes more than one meeting. And I'm not going to get into all the details in this class, but Just remember that if you're going to put some kind of a law or regulation on your members, it needs to go through an ordinance process. The other way the district exercises its authority is basically through the resolution process, which you do every meeting. You either have a simple resolution where you simply make a motion and second it, and it's entered into the minutes what action was taken. Very simple resolution. A lot of our districts have two or three very formal resolutions every year when they resolve to implement and adopt their budget and impose a tax or impose a fee. That is done through a very formal numbered resolution. Resolutions govern internal operations, and they're very simple. They can be done in one meeting. And again, my familiarity with you says that you probably do the very simple ones, and you're probably doing them on a pretty regular basis like you did this evening, just simply adopting your agenda. All members of the board are equals. You as a board can adopt a policy or through your incorporation bylaws, establish what roles your officers may play, which may give them some additional authority. But that is a board action to do that. Other than that, all board members are the same, and they only function as board members when they're in a meeting together, not individually out in the public, unless the board has given them the authority to do that, though the individuals. We have in us moving around the state and in the years we've been doing this training and serving on boards, we've seen some characteristics of effective boards. And you definitely have taken on some of those characteristics in the last few years that and become pretty effective yourselves. And I mean that as a compliment. And what we see in those boards is there's a clarity and alignment of the vision, mission, and values of the district. They basically get it while what they're there for. They're not there for any personal agenda. They're there for what's the vision, what's the mission of the organization, and we're here to help carry that out. And we do that with having a good set of values or a code of conduct how we conduct ourselves. Boards that are creative and collaborative partners, they see themselves as board members that are creative, and they collaborate with each other to help the staff and help the members make good decisions and move the organization forward. Also, board members generally have no secrets and no surprises. Effective boards do. You could be entrusted with some confidential information, which of course you need to keep confidential. But if it's a board item, we'll talk about how you can go into executive session to share that if it's appropriate for you to do that. But it's really important that if board members on effective boards, we see that they just share information. There's nobody trying to get one up on somebody else. There's no surprises and no secrets. Effective boards assume collective responsibility for the board's conduct and the conduct of the district, the district's performance. How things are done, the board could be a 3-2 vote, but once it's decided, the board accepts responsibility. Okay, that's what we're going to do. We're going to do it the best of our ability, best of the district's ability. And again, these are characteristics that we see of effective boards around the state in exercising their authority. Compensation, and again, under your articles of incorporation, you may have something a little different, but generally the statutory limit on compensation for board members is up to $50 a day or portion thereof, and you can be reimbursed for expenses when you're doing business for the district. Under both these items, there must be a board policy or something in place that the board has given the authority for the district to compensate the board members and or reimburse for expenses to staff. It isn't against the ethics laws to put those things in place. So generally, board members, once they're appointed or elected to a position, they can't usually be removed unless they're recalled through a very formal process. Your selection, I believe, is a little different. I believe you do your selections at an annual meeting. And at that annual meeting, changes can be made as long as the members, there's a quorum present and all that takes place. So in your articles of incorporation, it's a little more specific than what we teach to the general type of districts that we deal with on a regular basis.
George.
Yes.
So on the previous slide, You mentioned that something about a code of conduct. Is there a code of conduct that we're supposed to be following?
There's not a standard one that's out there that's like in an ORS or an administrative rule. But what we see is boards that have worked together to develop one, usually during their strategic planning process or something that they've done. And we have some samples that we share, but they're really straightforward. I mean, they're 6 to 7 items, and it really starts off with that we're gonna be friendly and we're gonna tell the truth. But there isn't a formal set, if that makes sense. But
okay, thank you.
Yeah, we definitely have them out there. In this slide, again, I'm talking with a district that is a public corporation. You have a little bit of different setups than most. But what we again see with very effective boards is that they have policies in place, either through their letters of incorporation or their bylaws or through policies. They have things in place that they follow as a board. And these are some foundational policies that we see with fire districts, water districts, sanitary districts, and what have you, that we really feel are important. Number one, I talked about a little bit, and I looked in ORS 554, and there's some specific language for your board president, for your board secretary, treasurer. But other than that, there's nothing outlining any board officer duties. Good boards have that in place. Here's what our board officers do. They have a policy that outlines a kind of a guiding principle, which we talked a little bit about. Is it a one voice guiding principle or a code of conduct or whatever it might be? Has a policy in place is how do we handle the press? Do we have somebody appointed? Is it always on Chase? Is it on our board president? Or is it on whoever? But if the press approaches your district, how is that handled? And that's always good to have, everybody understands that. I know that we at the fire district, of course, it was very specific on how those things were handled. How do board members and directors, you might say, interact with staff? Can everybody run to Chase and give him direction, or do you have some kind of a criteria, either through a policy or something, and effective boards have that in place where if there's a reason to give some direction or information to the CEO, here's how we do it. And it's either at a board meeting by the entire board, or it's by the board chair or the board president, or quote, however the board decides they want that done. But again, that's something that's handled at a board meeting, figured out, and then there's a policy written that is followed. How do individual board members represent the district? Is another policy that we see good boards have in place, meaning that, not to throw anybody on the bus, but you may remember a few years back, we had a representative of our port that was a board member that she felt that she was representing the board all the time. And whatever action she took, she was representing the port, when in reality, she was representing herself. And I don't mean that as criticism. I mean, there's a difference. You only represent the district when the district has given you the authority to go represent them. Other than that, you're representing yourself. People may see you as a board member and think you're representing the drainage district, when in reality, you're just trying to represent yourself. So you need to be careful. We speak with elected officials all the time about that, about it's really difficult for public officials sometimes to take off their hat. They're always seen with their hat on, and that can cause you some concerns and cause your board some embarrassment, and you need to be careful with that. But a policy outlined by the board, then everybody understands it. The last one that we see that all districts have that are really getting things done and boards have in place is how they're going to evaluate and review their CEO. No matter what you call that position, it's in the best interest of that position and the board that's all straightforward up front. Here's how we're going to do it. It's going to be done annually. And there's multiple ways to do it that have been successful. I'm not here to give you the perfect way because I don't think there is. I think there's a lot of ways that can be very effective. And I've seen them done. And I personally grew to enjoy my personnel evaluations when I was a CEO, because I always felt that when I walked out of that room, I knew where the board stood and I wasn't having to guess or how to assume where I thought the board was on certain things. So it's important that you have that in place, and as a board, you're unified. All right, indemnity. I was taking a look at ORS 554 today, and I was happy to see in there that the indemnity laws that covers all the other districts in the state also covers you. So you're entitled to indemnity under the Oregon Torts Claim Act for claims of negligence against the board, but you're not entitled if you're acting outside of course and scope of a position. So what that really means is a lot of you are business owners, family farms, whatever you may have, your private things. That is not at risk by the fact that you serve on the board. As long as you serve in the role as a board member and you stay within that role. The only time you can get trouble is if it's interpreted or decided that you acted outside course of scope. I don't know how you would do that in the particular position with the drainage district, but for some reason, let's just take a fictitious reason, you went down and shut off all the pumps because you thought it was the right thing to do. Unless there's a policy that says a board member can shut off all the pumps, you probably shouldn't do that. So if something happened with that, you'd be considered outside your course of scope. And I don't mean that as, I was just trying to use that as an example. We see this happen not a lot, but once in a while in the fire service and with irrigation districts, where board members get confused on what their role is and try to, you know, really do something they're not trained to do or whatever. So, but in your situation, I can't see that happening. But just understand that you and your family are fully protected under the Torts Claim Act of any actions by the board coming, even if you get named in an initial lawsuit, the first thing the judge is going to do is throw your name out. So that's under ORS 64. So you can be fined personally. You can be found personally liable for repayment of unlawful expenditures of public funds under ORS 294. If for some reason you as a board decide to spend public funds, corporation funds on something that's not appropriate. And the only example I'm aware of that's ever happened in the state of Oregon is many, many years ago, a small district of some type got all involved in a county commissioner's race and tried to influence who was going to be the next county commissioner in some county, and they donated public money to the person's election. Well, those gentlemen got to pay that back. Okay, now they didn't go to jail, but they did have to pay that back. So just be careful that you don't do that. Excuse me. You can become an eligible for public office, or if you're a member of, or if you're affiliated with any organization which teaches the doctrine of, or advocates for the overthrow of the government of the United States by force. I always leave that in there because that I've never had that happen in Oregon, but I guess we came close back in January of 21, but I don't know of any local people that were involved in that. Okay, that was kind of the intro and authority and stuff and boards, and tried to do a general outline. Any questions on that before I do a quick thing on public meetings? All right. Either I'm boring you, or you all fell asleep, or I did a good job. We'll just go with that.
I think you're doing a great job.
All right. I see you left your window shades open, Karen. I had to close mine. I thought the sun was going to set and blind me in here. Okay. Public meetings. It's not working for me. Can I? I think I can do this. I'm sorry. I'm just trying to move. Ooh. There we go. Yeah. All right, public meetings, application of law. Purposes of public meeting law. In the state of Oregon, we are a very transparent state. The purposes of our laws is to open meetings to the governing bodies, to the public, to give notice of the time and place of public meetings, and to make meetings accessible to those wishing to attend. I want to stop right there. Your meeting this evening is purely Zoom or virtual, okay? I don't have an issue with that. If this was your regular meeting, I don't have an issue with that because it's a training and it really made it pretty easy for me and for you. And it seems to be working pretty well. I'm noticing around the state, some entities are continuing to have virtual meetings only instead of transitioning to our public meetings that we used to have, and with the option of person being virtual. And I think that's going to get interesting. I think that's going to get challenged. in some areas, and I just want you to be aware of that. I personally don't have a position on it. It just causes me pause, if that makes sense. As a person that teaches us around the state, when a district is advertising that they're only going to have virtual meetings and people cannot attend in person and go someplace, I don't know that that is going to taste well to the public long term, but I could be wrong. Just wanted to give you a heads up on that. You have no obligation at your meeting to allow the people to speak, to have public to talk, unless it is a public hearing. If you're conducting a public hearing on an ordinance, or you're going to levy a fee, or there's an item that you as the board really desire to have a public hearing on, then absolutely you have the right to do that. And you have the right to listen to the public at all your meetings. What I'm trying to say to you is it's not required. It's not required by law, because you're conducting a business meeting for the district, not a meeting with the public. There's a difference there. There's a difference between public comment and also public discussion. And we encourage boards as SDAO to take public comment. We discourage public discussion. And the reason being is when you look at historic meetings that have got out of hand, meaning that law enforcement's even had to be called, it's because board members and staff got involved with debating the public rather than just collecting the data that the public was there to give. So again, that's just a cautionary discussion. You folks have been doing great. A public meeting is any meeting where a quorum of the decision-making body is present and is discussing or deliberating toward a matter of business. We'll show some examples of when this has got people in trouble, but remember that you need to be, if a quorum of your board is present, my example is, if you're all sitting in the same church pew, that isn't necessarily a problem, okay? That isn't necessarily an illegal meeting. You could make it one if you started deliberating with each other and discussing district business. Just being in the same church pew, talking about, you know, your church meeting that day or your cookie sales or whatever it is not a problem. It's when you start talking about district business that you could create a meeting. The other one where we see people having a misunderstanding is any meeting of a body formed to advise a public body needs to be held in public. For example, if for some reason you decided as a board to appoint a committee of members to give a report back to the board on something, that committee would have to meet in public just like you do, okay? Now, the opposite of that is if you turn as a board to Chase and say, Chase, we'd like you to go out and research this issue and come back and give a report to the board, and Chase decides as a staff member to call up a few people to get together with him and talk about this and maybe form a committee opinion, he's not required to meet in public because he's staff. Staff is reporting to the board, not a committee appointed by the board, if that makes sense to you. Sometimes I confuse people on that, sometimes they get it, but remember, staff is basically, think about it, if you're a large organization of 4 or 5 staff members, they meet every day. And they're going to make recommendations to the board. They're not required to meet in public. We did have a case which blows me away. This was this many years ago, 12 years ago, whatever this was now. The Dumby versus Hanby Sorensen Fleener and the Lane County Board of Commissioners. By the way, Hanby Sorensen and Fleener were the Lane County Board of Commissioners when this was filed. This has to do with email. I'm not going to read this to you. I'm going to give you the George Knuckle Cliff Notes. Email is the best communication tool you as a volunteer elected official have been given, period. It is a great tool. Improper use of that tool can create a public meeting and get your hands slapped, okay? Here's my rule. Here's my book notes on it, or my theory on it. Use it as a tool. A board member emailing other board members, hey, I just noticed that we got a slight leak. Or that wouldn't be a good example. You send that to Chase. Hey, board members, I'll just use something simple. Hey, board members, I'm not going to be at the next meeting. Okay. That's just a notice. That doesn't create a meeting. If that email included something like, I'm curious about your opinion on item B on the agenda. Now that you've asked a question, if individual board members want to answer that board member via email, okay, they can, as long as they don't copy all or hit or ship it on to another board member, their opinion. So never hit reply all is number one, and never forward your thoughts on some of the other board members' thoughts through email. You have created a meeting, and it only takes two of you to do that, to create that third person. Does that make any questions on that, what I'm saying there? Don't create a serial meeting and don't create a meeting. All right, you guys get it. Use email, nothing wrong with email. And also there's nothing wrong with email being used. And I think you use, I've been working with a couple different boards recently, but what's that, you can do a survey, like if you're trying to schedule this meeting, that was not creating a meeting. There's a perfect example. Karen's email to, hey, can we get a date to George to do this training? You didn't create a meeting by doing that. You're just trying to schedule a darn meeting. Does that make sense? So that usually goes by okay. Okay.
So just no opinions about board business of any kind.
Don't do any dialoguing, any opinions. Right. Sharing information. The first email is never the problem. The person that writes the email that says, hey, I want to share information about, you know, the color of the new pipe we're buying. That's not the problem. The problem is the response to that. Okay. All right. Public notice is required for all public meetings and must be provided for all regular, special, and emergency meetings. Let's talk about emergency meetings for a second. All an emergency meeting is, if you've had something come up and it's so urgent that it has to be done in less than 24 hours, that's when you have an emergency meeting. All emergency meetings are for is so you can give less than 24 hours notice. That's all they're for. It must be an emergency. Otherwise, there's no reason to have it. I saw a district the other day have an emergency meeting and they gave like 72 hours notice. They called it an emergency meeting. That was a special meeting. It wasn't an emergency meeting. So that's the thing about emergency meetings. Be provided for all advisory groups and subcommittee meetings. Be provided for public officials of the body holding the meeting. Included the time, place of the meeting and the principal subject, just like what you did for this. That was perfect. Okay. Make sure that if you have any public members that have requested that they be notified of all your meetings, that they individually get notified. And you can do that via email. You must notify the press that normally covers you. You're not required to post your meetings, but you are required to notify the press if you are normally covered by a press. You can do that email just by sending your agenda out, and generally you don't get any pushback on that. Remember that if you're going to have a special meeting, you must give no less than 24 hours notice of that meeting to all interested parties and regular posting places. Agenda planning, public meeting agendas, a couple of things we like to emphasize here, that you have a policy in place that says who's going to put that agenda together. Is it the board chair, the board president? They consult with the general manager. How's that done? Make sure your agenda does that. That you have some elements on your agenda that include the meeting place and date and time so that it's right there on your agenda. If somebody grabs your agenda, they know at the top, here's when the meeting's going to be, here's where it's going to be and what time. This is just a sample of an agenda that we think works pretty well for the majority of our districts. This may look something like yours, it may not, but the two items on here that I always like to emphasize is, even though you're not required to take public input, I believe, that comments from the public on agenda items, if you're going to take them early in the meeting. Take it from a standpoint of, it's a data collection thing for you as a board member. They're interested in an item that's on your agenda. Have them discuss that item. take down your points and thank them for coming. Go ahead then and get your staff reports, work with your staff, get any committee reports you want, then do your business. What is that business? Agenda item A, B, C, D, whatever it may be. Now you are done by this agenda. Now you are done with the business of your evening, okay? Now is a time that if there's other public members there or the same public members, and they want to discuss, they want to bring up something about something that wasn't on the agenda, you can let them bring that up. But again, you're not there to debate them. You're just there to listen to what their concerns are, take it down, maybe refer it to Chase, maybe refer it to, you know, a committee or something, but you're not there to take action on it, for heaven's sakes. Don't let me walk in there and say I need a drainage ditch put in front of my house tomorrow. Get it on a future agenda if you've never heard of it before. Then you can have good of the order, any board member reports, and then state when your next meeting is going to be in. Good night. Again, these are just elements of an agenda that we see on a lot of board for a lot of districts that we think are effective and kind of how they run through. The main emphasis there is how we deal with the public. Executive sessions. You are allowed to have executive sessions. They're very specific. They must be very defined while you're going into executive session. Here are the listings. I'm just going to quickly go through them with you. I provide these to you in a couple of ways in your handouts and what have you, but here's where they're at. You can use an executive session to discuss employment of individual employees or agents, as long as it's been advertised and there's regular procedure in place and the opportunity for the public to comment during the initial phase was allowed. For example, if you needed to hire a new Chase and you reviewed in order to do that in executive session, you'd have to review the job description, review the salary range, and review the process you're going to do in a public meeting with the public. So anybody could comment if they wanted to. But by doing that, then when you get down to your people you want to interview, you can interview them in executive session because you did that in public session. The public got to say, you know, we want Chase 2, and then we want him to be like this. So you listen to that, and now you can do the in executive session. If you don't do the first part, then really you can't discuss employment in executive session with candidates. So we work with districts all the time on that, and that's one of the ones they get hung up on. You can use executive session to discuss discipline or discharge of a public employee, to conduct employee performance evaluations, to consult with your district labor negotiator, which you don't have, to conduct labor negotiations if both sides agree to it, to consult. Executive session be called only for the topics defined in ORS 192.660, to consult with regarding specific real estate transactions, to discuss for public record exempt from disclosure, to meet with legal counsel, to discuss litigation filed or likely to be filed. Here's a key one. If you think litigation is going to be filed against your district, or you've been given notice, a tort claim notice, absolutely get a hold of your attorney, get a hold of us, not me personally, but our legal counsel, and have a special meeting on an executive session to discuss that. So before anything, before anything legally has been filed, if you just get a notice, because actions you take during that period can help in your defense down the road. So, and that's why it's allowed. You're allowed to go into executive session for that, but make sure you do that under the guidance of an attorney and guidance of SDAO's legal advice, legal counsel. The other thing that's here that's fairly new is the last bullet. I want to make sure you understand. You probably have some kind of security systems that involve your equipment and your facilities. When you're going to discuss that systems, how it's programmed, how it's installed, make sure you do that in executive session. Otherwise, you're just telling the bad guys how you do it if they want to listen. So that is there. And believe it or not, 5 or 6 years ago, or maybe 10 years ago now, that wasn't part of it. You couldn't do that, but now you can. Key things to remember about executive sessions: public notice citing the applicable statutory authority. We gave you a cheat sheet that I believe Chase shared with you that lays that out for you. You must include the media if they're present. a representative of the media. You do not have to have all the media present in your executive session, but you must have a representative if they are present. You must instruct them that they can't report on anything that's discussed in the appropriate executive session. Cite the authority into the minutes. So your minutes of executive session are simply, we're going to executive session under this authority for this reason. We came out at this time and who was present. If you ever do go into executive session and there's general public available and they were curious when you're going to come out, please try to tell them you think it's going to take 10 minutes, 20 minutes, or an hour. Sometimes you don't have an idea how long it might be. Just be open and honest with them. Let them make their own decision if they're going to hang around or not. Reconvene your regular session to make any final decision. Remember, when you're in executive session, you cannot take any votes. You can't even really reach a clear consensus. I think the key thing for good board presidents, good board chairs, as they have their discussion, hear their reports in executive session, and a decision needs to be made in open session, that they simply look at their fellow board members and ask the question, is anybody here prepared to make a motion? And if one of them or two of them say yes, then you're probably done with your executive session and you can go out into regular session. And if a decision needs to be made, you get the motion made, second it, and have the discussion. The attorneys advise us to take minutes of our executive sessions. Most of our districts record them. And if you record it, that has an archive effect on it. Your minutes do not have to be very thorough. They just simply have to show what was discussed, who was in there, when you went into it, and when you came out. But your audio recording, of course, would have more detail, and there's different retention laws that govern each of those, and I don't have those off the top of my head, although your written minutes are forever. All right, questions on executive sessions? All right. To conclude this part, what happens if we don't follow the rules for executive sessions? Well, if you don't follow the rules, board members can be held personally liable for abusing the executive session privileges. Executive sessions are governed by the Ethics Commission. We're going to talk about the Ethics Commission soon. Currently, the only part of public meetings that's governed is executive sessions. So you can get an ethics complaint filed against the board for misusing executive sessions. You can be liable for any civil penalties and attorney fees up to $1,000 per violation of the Oregon Ethics Laws. And that's why we put this in here, because the Oregon Ethics Commission currently does govern the executive session if somebody files a complaint against you. Now, there is a bill before the legislature. I have been told that the bill is pretty well dead in committee, but there was a bill introduced for all public meeting violations to be governed by the Ethics Commission, which would have meant that they would have all been individually responsible and there would have been penalties involved. That bill died. So it's just the executive session, again, which makes sense because our public meetings are transparent. It's when you violate the executive session that makes them non-transparent. I put this in every time because I always like to remind board presidents and CEOs and about how do you prepare a legal and effective board meeting? You just can't show up at your meeting date and time and have a good meeting if you haven't done any planning for it. So we really emphasize this, that you plan the meeting, develop an agenda, and organize the content. Now, why do I have to say that? Well, because there are 900 special districts in the state of Oregon. They're not all as sophisticated as you are, okay? We have people out there serving on boards that are trying their best to run a little sanitary district in, you know, I call them wagon wheel Oregon, and believe me, they're doing it all themselves. And so sometimes they mess up. I went to a meeting in Meacham one time that was I met some of the nicest people in the world, but it was the most disorganized meeting I've ever been to in my life. And I really felt sorry for them. We since have helped them get better at it, and they're doing better. But I'll tell you what, no offense to anybody here, but it was the best chocolate chip cookies I ever had. Ooh, baby, they were good. Because one lady brought fresh cookies to every meeting. So in advance, review material in advance as a board member. Be prepared. If you have questions about something that's on your agenda, you should have access to your staff and to other board members to get clarifying, do some clarifying questions in advance. You visiting with another board member, visiting with Chase prior to board meeting is not a violation of the board of the public meeting laws. You visiting with three people and the three of you developing your joint opinion, that's a problem, okay? But just getting some clarifying question answered by a fellow board member or by Chase, that's just good business. You're getting prepared for the meeting. Be sure you know and follow public meeting laws. We went over them pretty quickly, but you've got them in your hands. You make sure you satisfy the notice requirements. Again, there's no obligation to give members of the public the right to speak at your business meeting. Okay, you may, but you have no obligation to do that. Treat members of the public and other board members with respect. Limit public debate. We basically say do not debate. Listen, thank people, but don't debate. And try to avoid public squabbles. We see them happen from time to time. People get a little carried away, but that's not a business meeting. You're all business people and understand how those work. The other thing is, and Rob, I think you do a great job at this, but make sure you elect a board president, a board chair, appoint one that wants to be the leader, wants to run a, can run a good meeting, knows how to follow an agenda, understands Robert's Rules of Orders, but doesn't force them down your throat. Just understands that what the rules of order are. We kind of went over an agenda with you. We think it's important that you hear from your staff before you make any decisions, that all decisions should follow a good motion and a second, so that everybody in the room understands what are you taking action on. It should be recorded in your minutes. There should be good discussion and dialogue and deliberation. Good board presidents, board chairs, seek comments from all board members. Don't let board members sit on their thumbs. You know, somebody sitting there quietly. I had a board member for years that even as the CEO, a fire chief, I would say, hey, you know, John, how do you feel about this? I haven't heard you say anything. It's important that you pull that information out so that everybody has their opportunity. Call for votes. Make sure that all the votes are publicly stated. None of your votes can be secret that I'm aware of. And that it's recorded in the minutes how people voted. It can be unanimous. You can vote unanimous. There's nothing wrong with that. But if it's a 4-1, 3-2, whatever, they must be recorded. Once you take that vote and the decision is made, move on. Go on to the next subject. Don't dwell on what you've already done and make sure your minutes accurately reflect the essence of the meeting. They do not have to be verbatim, but they need to really accurately reflect what went on at the meeting so that people can understand. Historically, that can be looked at as a historic document and know what went on at that meeting. All right. Questions about public meetings?
Out of curiosity, getting the essence of the meeting, you said it doesn't need to be verbatim. Does it need to include, I know we record them too, but for the handwritten part, even if we didn't record it, does it need to include exactly who made what statement or just in general what was said?
Okay. I'm going to go with your second part, and I'm going to say this. If a person is making a motion or a second, that's accurately recorded as that. John moved, Sally seconded, blank, okay? If John is saying, well, you know, back in 1939, we did it this way, we appreciate that, but that's part of the general dialogue over reaching the decision. So your comment can be board members openly discussed whatever the subject was. You know, you don't have to get that detail, okay? But you need to collect, because remember, all your minutes are going to be approved by the board or reviewed by the board at the next meeting. You want to get the majority of stuff, you want to get it in there so you get your minutes approved. You don't want board members going, wait a minute, you didn't put in here that we discussed, you know, the color of that pipe for 7th Street or whatever. So you just be careful with that. But no, they do not need to be verbatim. There's some really good examples out there. I see minutes from a lot of our local districts here in Columbia County. And generally, I mean, how do I want to say this? The larger the district and the more staff they have, the more detailed the minutes are because they have time to do it. The smaller the district and the more volunteers doing it, it's more general, but it still works for that district and works for their constituents. Now, if a board member, not a member of the public, but a board member says, hey, I would like to have this statement put in the minutes. You know, I, George, agree with this because, you know, I really like the color orange. That board member can request that, and you probably should do that, okay? I don't know that you're required to do that, but that's just good boardsmanship and good board thing. If they requested something like that, put it. Does that make sense to you, what I'm saying?
Yes.
Okay, is that Chris? Or no, Amanda?
Yeah, Amanda.
Okay, Amanda, thanks. All right, did I help you with that at all, Amanda?
Yeah, that made a lot more sense.
Okay, great. All right, let's quickly talk about ethics. I'm sorry, is there any other questions? Because I really need you to speak up if you do, because I've shrunk down the picture so I can see my slides. All right, let's talk about ethics. First thing is the application of the law. In the state of Oregon, we have what's called the Government Ethics Commission. It's peers of your peers, a lot of elected official folks appointed by the governor that serve on a panel, a board that has staff, and how they're funded is local governments are subject to municipal audit, are charged a fee to help fund it. And I believe the minimum fee is like $250. So we as special districts out here, we help fund the Government Ethics Commission of the state of Oregon. We didn't used to. It used to be a line item budget of the general fund of the state. The Ethics Commission got on their really doing some investigations into senator and elected officials, and they kicked them out of the budget. So that's how that happened. So now it's all of us help pay for it. The state pays too, but we pay. So the laws apply to all public officials. And who are public officials? Elected before and during office. We have an election going on right now in the state of Oregon. All the candidates that have filed for those offices, during the election period, these ethics rules apply to them. And a lot of them don't know that. But it's in their material when they go file for their office. So even during your election for the first time, these ethics rules apply. So they apply to appointed volunteers, employees, and relatives. But the relatives are very defined. It's not every relative you have, okay? So pretty much all of us that are within my listening this evening, and including myself on some of this, I'm still what's called a public official, and all of you are. Your relatives also have, these rules also apply to, and it's your spouse, your parents, your step-parent, child, sibling, step-sibling, son-in-law, daughter-in-law of the public official or the public official's spouse. Any individual for whom the public official has a legal support obligation or who benefits financially from the public official's employment with the public entity. So, board members are not employed by the district. They are volunteers, but these rules apply to them also, okay? Because they are a public official. The thing that I think is interesting is this definition of relatives is people get hung up on cousins and aunts and uncles. For the purpose of ethics, they are not a relative. Okay. But your siblings are, your brothers and sisters are. And your, of course, your children and your son-in-laws and daughter-in-laws or whatever you are. So when you get into this and you think you may have a conflict of interest or a problem with ethics from a relative, make sure you understand if that it's really a relative under the ethics rules. Okay? No nepotism. A public official may not appoint, employ, or promote a relative to a paying position within the public body on which the official serves unless the official complies with conflict of interest procedures. I'm going to review those conflict of interest procedures with you just shortly, but let's just put it this way. No nepotism does not mean that your drainage district could not hire one of your relatives or your spouse. That's not what it means. It just means that you cannot be involved in the hiring process of that person, okay? Karen, if you don't mind, I'm just going to use it as a good example. If the district for some reason needed some paving done and Will Kesey wanted to bid on that, he has every right to bid on that. Karen just can't vote on it because it's a direct conflict of interest, okay? But the board can choose to hire Will. That's not a problem, okay? As long as she just can't be involved. And the same would apply for any of the rest of you that may have some relative that either wants to work for the district or do a contract for the district. No nepotism doesn't mean they can't be hired. It just means you can't play, okay? And the same thing applies to a public official cannot directly supervise a relative. In the fire service, we run into this, especially the large organizations run into this all the time. You'll have brothers and sisters, mom and daughter, mom and son, that work for the same organization. They absolutely can. They just can't supervise one another. And that sometimes can be interesting. But anyway, that's just no nepotism. Okay. Now, George, what this is go ahead, Gary.
This is Gary Wheeler. I just had a question for you that kind of relates to that. And this may help with some of the newer board members. It's been an issue for us in the past to try to figure out exactly how the public bidding process works and at what point we're actually obligated to get additional bids. In many cases, just mobilizing the equipment can be very expensive. We might have a beaver dam, we might have a tree that's fallen across a ditch, something like that. Potentially there's a landowner nearby that has an excavator and, you know, can mobilize pretty easily. What do we need to do to be careful and make sure we're covered on something like that so that there's not a conflict?
Good question, Gary. Yeah, thank you. There's a couple ways that can be handled. One is you can do a open call once a year, once every 3 years for what you might call an emergency response. I don't know what you'd call it, but where you look for somebody that can come at your beck and call, you might say 6 hours response time or an hour response time or whatever. And you put out a call for quotes or a call, you know, somebody to give you a bid or to give you a proposal, an RFP on how they would handle that. And again, you consider that at the board level, at the whatever level your policy has you do that, either at staff or board, and that is awarded. And it's kind of with some organizations, it's not even a cost. It's just on notice that this is who we're going to call when this happens, and this is how it was awarded, and when the rate kicks in at the phone call, and here's the rate. And it gives people an opportunity to, if they're interested in doing that and they can meet your criteria, they could put in a proposal. That's one way I've seen it done. And you kind of caught me. It's basically a request for a proposal for organizations that don't have the ability to quickly respond to something. Okay. And
are you suggesting that possibly, George, that could be someone that was a board member or affiliate of a board member? The kinds of examples absolutely that I'm talking about here are many times. I mean, it's maybe less than a $2,500 project, certainly in some cases, much less than that. And you really can't get people too interested in coming out and doing a bid on something like that. And that's where my question comes from.
Yeah, no, you can absolutely have that in place. There's actually limits. You know, I don't get into public contracting and public procurement, but, you know, I could work with Chase to look that up where there are limits in place. And some of that is, you don't have to, you just got to get a quote. It's not even a bid. You know, you just call somebody up and go, hey, if this happened, what would you charge me to come do it? And you just record that. And when it happens, you can call the one you want. You know, as long as it's within some criteria that you can defend it. You absolutely have. It's when you're getting it, when you would really get into the issue is if you were going to do, and I think it's, I don't quote me on this, but I think it's like a $500,000 project before you really get into the full blown, you know, prevailing wage and all that stuff that applies. It's a big number now. So as long as you're showing that you get quotes on some kind of routine basis, meaning we did it on a 3-year deal where when we had emergencies, you know, we needed a plumber, for heaven's sakes. We did a 3-year deal where, okay, what would you charge us per hour to do our emergency plumbing? And we got quotes for different plumbers. Some of them said, I don't want to mess with it. You know, call Joe. But we did that publicly and everybody knew that, hey, okay, so this is who we're going to call.
Is there a level where we actually have to get quotes? In other words, when we get into, you know, really small projects, sometimes people are reluctant to even want to help out because they don't want to have a conflict of interest. Is there a dollar limit there? I mean, $500,000 is, you know, a bunch. That's not really where my basis of my question's coming from. Is there, you know, some threshold that we need to look at?
Yes. And I'm going to tell you that they have been changed and I don't have a number for you. Okay. It was when I was doing it, it was $5,000. Okay. That number's changed. I do not know what the new number is. Okay. All I was required to do up to $5,000 was have a record that I called 3 different plumbers. Okay. Now it's a much higher number than that. So, and I'm sorry, Gary, that I don't have that for you.
You actually have to, one of the challenges we've had in the past over the years, you actually have to have a response from those 3 different people. In many cases, you know, we can have a lot of difficulty getting someone to come into the area. And if you can get them to, you know, even want to think about coming in the area, they maybe don't want to do work here because it's too expensive to mobilize or that sort of thing on a small project. That's kind of what I'm asking.
Yeah.
Good question.
Yeah. I don't know who's listening in on this. You don't have, I mean, as long as you document what you've done, you know, on this date at this time, I called ABC, no response 3 days later. I called XYZ, no response 3 days later. I called AB, you know, the next one, bam, I had somebody here the next day. As long as you got that documented and it's, you're fine, because at least that's what I've seen. Okay. And it's, again, it's under a certain amount and it's more than $5,000, but I don't have a number for you. It's not, again, I know that everything kicks in at $500,000, but that's everything. That's a full blown big deal. On the smaller ones today, again, because for all the same reasons you brought up, Gary, you're not going to get Kiewit come out and bid on a big project, a small project of yours. They're going to
exactly.
They're going to come out and bid on the $2 million job, you know. But yeah, so no, you're generally, remember where you're going to get your complaint. That's what I always tell people. Think about where you're going to get your complaint. You're going to get your complaint from the guy that didn't get called. That's a lot like the guy you used or the gal. Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay. That's the ones you want to make sure you cover. You know, that I'm just going to be bluntly honest with you. I was always very careful about that. If I wanted to use electrician A, I had to make sure I called electrician Z. So at least I got, you know, I covered myself.
I appreciate the explanation, George. That's something that's been kind of a reoccurring question for us. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, you know, okay. Thank you, Gary. It was good. All right. Let's talk about financial gain. You may not, as a public official, use or attempt to use your official position or office to obtain financial gain or to avoid a financial detriment that would not otherwise be available, but for the holding of the official position or office. It includes your relatives or household members, businesses. Example, use of district equipment and facilities, accepting discounts from district vendors. Okay. What is this saying? You just can't be in your position to and then gain financially or avoid a debt because you're in that position. That doesn't mean that you can't go out to lunch with somebody, or you can't be courted by a vendor. It's just, there's limits on it. Okay. There's definitely limits. It's up to $50 per year by any vendor one time. Okay.
George,
yes.
Would you clarify avoiding financial detriment just a little more, please?
Well, it means avoiding a debt is what that means. If just because you hold the position, you're not going to have to incur, or have some kind of debt eliminated, is what that means. That's a financial gain by not being have to pay a debt. I don't know if I have a good example.
I think it's pretty easy to understand, obtaining a financial gain from a conflict of interest. But avoiding a financial detriment, I just want to make sure that's clear to everyone. I'm not sure it's clear to me all the time, but
yeah,
I'm not that worried about it. Not that I don't think it's important. I'm just not concerned that, we're going to end up in that place, but I just want to make sure we all understand what it means.
I wish I had a good example for you.
That's okay.
I just always just put it out that way. Just avoiding, gain. Avoiding a debt is a gain, in my opinion. So that's where I see it.
Okay.
Public officials may not participate in any personal action taken by a public agency that would impact the employment of a relative. If the hire is a direct conflict of interest, must comply with conflict of interest requirements. I talked about that a little bit. You can't accept gifts if they exceed $50 from a source that has a legislative or administrative interest in the public official's governmental agency. So you can, it's like I've told people, you can have you can go to dinner with somebody that has some kind of legislative or administrative interest. You just can't go to a really nice dinner. And today, I don't even know if you can go to a bad dinner for $50 right now, but let's talk a little bit about a legislative and administrative interest with respect to the public body. Can the giver sell things to the district, submit bids to the district, get a license or permit from the district, advocate to the district and lobby the district in some way, or be affected by an employment decision? Excuse me. Again, board members generally, you don't have an issue with this as long as you remember that $50. If somebody's trying to advocate for something, and where we see this a lot, not necessarily with your particular district, but with vendors. And vendors can actually get in trouble themselves with the Ethics Commission, believe it or not, if they aggressively try to violate and force on our elected officials. Their goodwill. Excuse me. Oh, man. Okay. So don't do that. What is a conflict of interest? In Oregon, it's pretty straightforward. We have two conflicts of interest, conflict of interest, potential conflict. When you are a close family member, you may benefit from action of the board or some action that you want to take, okay? Or an actual conflict where you or a close family member will benefit. as a board member, if it's actual, you must disclose actual and potential conflicts of interest. If it's actual, you cannot vote or participate in discussion. My example of this that I use when I'm doing this to bigger group is the board member that has a close family member that's an electrician, and the CEO brings to the board some need to do some rewiring of a substantial amount in some of their buildings. when the CEO brings that to the board and you're discussing whether you should be doing that electrical project or not, that board member that has that family member that's the electrician that may bid on the project has a potential conflict of interest. Meaning that if the district does go out for bids, they may bid, okay? That board member must simply just say, hey, I got a potential conflict. You know that my brother is a local electrical contractor. He may want to bid on this project. No problem. You can discuss it, and you can vote whether the district should go out and get the bids. So it's put in the minutes that board member A declared a potential conflict of interest because of a brother that's the Christian electrical contractor. Bingo. The vote happens, 5-0, CEO, go out and get us bids. 2 months later, the CEO brings those bids back, and one of the bidders is the brother of the board member. And the district is going to vote on awarding that bid tonight. That board member must declare an actual conflict of interest and cannot vote on it or discuss it. On a five-member board, the exception should never come into play. If you were a three-member board, that board member that declared an actual conflict of interest may come back and vote if it's necessary to award the bid. Okay. Five-member board should never happen. But on the three-member board, you could get a situation where you have 1-1 split and somebody's got to come back. You got to bring the person back to vote. They can't discuss it, but they can vote. Potential actual conflict of interest. Questions on that? I get this question quite a bit. And let me tell you my basic rule on it. If you think you have a potential conflict of interest, declare it and just tell the board what it is. Tell them why you think you have a potential conflict of interest. You'll know if you have an actual. Look what the actual says. You or a close family member will benefit from the action of the board. Will benefit. Make sense? Good. The Ethics Commission has said that you as public officials may do some things that you can't get in trouble for. You can accept the reimbursement of expenses from your public employer for expenses incurred while on official business. You can accept unsolicited awards for professional achievement. You can accept gifts from a source when it is reasonable to believe that that source does not have a legislative or administrative interest in the public official's governmental agency. You can accept food and beverages provided when acting in official capacity. You can have reasonable food and lodging and travel expenses paid for a public official and a company and relative when acting in official capacity. This is a change during my career. Early in my career, when we traveled on behalf of the district to trainings or to conferences, we were allowed to take our spouses with us. But if there was any kind of an upcharge, any kind of a food charge, anything for the spouse, we paid it as employees, not as public officials. The district could not pay it. That is no longer true. The ethics laws in Oregon now allow for reasonable relative accompanying expenses if the board has a policy allowing that. Okay, so individual districts get to make that decision, not the state. Example being, at one time in motels, in my lifetime, at one time, if you were a single person in a motel room, it was this charge. If it was two people, it was this charge. Now they don't do that anymore, but if they did, the district could pay both of those. The district can also pick up food for the relative that's coming in. And what brought this about is some of our elected officials really needed somebody to travel with them. A more humanistic approach, districts can put a policy in place that takes care of the expenses up to a point of any accompanying relative. You can accept gifts when the item or event is in specific exception to the definition of gift described in ORS 244.2055B. I didn't write those down. I just said, hey, if you want to see what's an exception, there it is. You can accept contributions to your legal expense trust fund. And I'm sure you all have one of those. I always thought that's pretty cute because I think some of our elected officials do at the state level. Okay, ethics rules. There are penalties. If you're bored on a Sunday afternoon and you're sitting at home and it's a day like today that was raining cats and dogs, you can go on the Oregon Ethics Commission's site and see what kind of complaints have been filed against elected officials and districts around the state. It is interesting to see what is filed, okay? And there are elected officials out there that are getting penalized up to $5,000 per violation. The thing to remember that if you have an ethics complaint filed against you individually, your district cannot pay the fine if you're found guilty. That's a personal problem, not a district problem. I know of some elected officials that have had some ethics complaints against them and have had to pay some fines. But a lot of times ethics complaints get filed and they're unfounded. So when you get that, if you ever get a letter from the Ethics Commission saying you've done something, don't panic. We're here to help you. We'll with your district work through that. However, that if you are found guilty, that the penalty is on you. Nobody can pay that but you. Your district can't pay it. Your church county can't pay it. It is on you, okay? All right, questions on ethics. That's the George short version. Don't do it. Okay? I like to end my presentation with talking a little bit about having expectations. As elected officials, as you sit at a board meeting, you all volunteer your time to be there. You all volunteer your time to serve on the board and do what you can to help your district be as effective as it can be and provide the services that it's been entrusted to provide. It's a pretty simple framework. You have your patrons, your members put your elected officials in place. The board then hires your CEO. Your CEO may have people to work for them, have some sort of staff or departments to work for them. It's a pretty straightforward process. The board is accountable to the voters. And it's important that you remember that. The board is appointed, is really what's accountable to, in your case, the members, okay? And that authority comes from those members through the state. The general manager, your CEO, is accountable to the board. They feel some obligation, and they should, to the members, but they really work for the board, and they're the one employee of the board. Any staff that they have, hopefully you have report directly to that CEO, that general manager, whatever your title may be, and the board stays out of that element, okay? Years ago, I met with a bunch of elected officials, and I kind of took them aside and said, look, what expectations do you have of your fellow board members? And they looked at me like I was nuts. But we really started talking about it. And over the years, I've refined this. But here's what the majority of elected officials said about what they expected from their fellow board members. Number one, they expected them to get orientated to the board, that they have a good understanding of what the organization is about, that they just don't get elected to a board that they don't understand anything about, and they don't know even know what services they provide or why they provide them, okay? But once they're on the board, they have expectations that the individuals will be prepared and informed for that meeting. They will have an understanding that, look, we're all gonna be as best prepared and informed about the items on our agenda as we can be. We're gonna be honest, courteous, and we're gonna be on time. I really was appreciative tonight about when 6 o'clock rolled around, some of you spoke right up and said, hey, it's 6 o'clock, let's get going. That showed courtesy to everybody there, not only myself, but to all of the fellow board members. And that's an expectation that you should have of your fellow board members. That doesn't mean that a board member isn't going to be late once in a while. But as long as they let the board know, hey, I'm cutting hay, and it's going to be a while or whatever, that they know they're coming. Have an expectation that you as a board member and your fellow board members are respectful of each other and of the organization, that they're friendly, that they represent the board positions and actions. You don't always have to agree with every decision the board makes, but if they make it, the majority of the board has made it, that you represent it to the best of your ability. And you understand your roles and responsibilities and the roles and responsibilities of the general manager, and you work through that general manager. Now, Chase, I'm not leaving you out of this, buddy. Sorry. I think good boards, and what I've heard from good boards, is they should have expectations of their staff. Now, really, their general manager, their CEO is their only staff, but they have other staff members that may report to them from time to time. We came up with this list, and we think it's a good one, and we modify it from time to time. But number one, we expect our staff to be prepared and informed about the items that are on our agenda. Something could come up during our meeting that they weren't prepared for, but they didn't know about it. So we understand that. But by golly, if it's on our agenda, we expect them to be part of our experts on those items. That our staff gives us directions, or excuse me, gives us options, not direction. What are the options available to us when making the decision? Have a recommendation for a staff if you can. Have a recommendation, but don't make the decision for us. Give us a recommendation. You can do A, A would do this. If you do B, B would do this. We recommend you do B, and here's why. Provide organized board packets. Hopefully prior to your board meeting, you're getting some support from your staff, from your board president that says, look, here's your board packet. Here's the material. I really was pleased with Chase this morning. We provided some information, some material that we wanted to make sure all the board members had and staff had. He not only had the written ones that I gave him, but he made sure they were put online and they were on your website. And I was like, right on. I'm going to steal him from you guys. That was great. Oh, I didn't mean that. I didn't say that. Okay. Sorry, Karen. But communicate, staff. Communicate with us. No secrets. No matter how bad the news is, how good the news is, we as board members need to know. Don't let me hear about it at the table of knowledge someplace. Let me hear about it from you. Be honest with us, courteous and on time, all the time. There's no reason to get cranky. There's no reason to not have courtesy. There's no reason we don't start our meetings on time. If there is, let us know and we'll adjust. Once the board has made a decision, represent our positions. You may not always agree with it, but represent it. If you feel we've reached a bad conclusion, give us the facts that help us change that decision, not just you don't agree with it. It's got to be some facts involved because we make decisions on our facts. And understand your roles and responsibilities. Okay. Look at that. I'm 6 minutes early. How about questions? Anybody have any discussion? I really appreciated that Gary brought up some stuff. Anything else? Let me unshare this so I can see everybody. There we go.
George, you said that the board is accountable to the voters. This is on slide 37.
Uh-huh.
And that is our land ownership.
Right. Yes. Your members. Your,
so well, yes. So we're not the general public, just right. Just the landowners.
So the people that who puts you in office? Yeah. That's who you're accountable to.
Okay. It's clarifying.
Yep.
Yay. Well, that was great, George.
George, I think you did a great job.
Even though I heard
job.
It already once a few years ago, it was a good refresh for me. Thank you so much.
Good, good. Well,
folks, you all have stuff in your packets too, right? George, do you want to explain what you've given to us in our packets really quick before we sign off?
Sure. Well, the first thing was, of course, you got a copy of the slides. And the second thing was we actually reproduced and Chase actually put up on the site the Oregon Ethics Commission manual, which now you have your own copy. I always kid board members that should be under your pillow at night. So you get a lot of it through osmosis, through. But we went over the highlights with you that's in there, that's in that. Let's see.
Can I ask you, George, has that changed since the time you came and spoke with us before?
The one that we gave you today is the latest version, and it's been updated since 2010, because I used to be able to, so I don't know what the date on the one was, but it's been updated, but not significantly changed, no.
Okay.
No. Help me, Chase, what was the other item we put in there?
Well, the one that I put on the website was the one, it came from SDAO, but it's actually lifted directly from the Oregon Ethics Commission's website. Right. So it's published by the Oregon Ethics Commission. It's not SDAO.
Right. That's the ethics manual. But the other one was the meeting thing. That's what it was.
Oh, yeah, the meeting
sheet. The two-sided document. And that's a really good tool when you're thinking about an executive session or you got some questions about should we notice something. That's a really good tool.
And then you also put read before each board meeting.
Yeah, that is something we didn't put up on the website. That is something that I acquired from a school district in Missouri, believe it or not. I went to a national conference and I sat in on a public meetings thing there. I got to listen to a consultant talk about working with a 9-member school board.
My gosh.
Oh my God. It was unbelievable the problems they had. And he finally helped them develop this document. And I took it, I asked him, I says, can I take it and change it to like a sanitary district or a health district or a fire district? He says, sure, do anything you want with it. So that the one you have may be my one that refers to one of those types of districts, but the principle is the same. And that's why you'll always hear me refer to when you're meeting, when Rob brings your meeting to order, you're in a business meeting for the district. Not your own personal business, but the district's business. And it really, that I believe that document really helps board members focus on, okay, why am I here? Why am I here? I'm here to do the business for the district.
George, do we have, I know that I kind of put you on the spot, but do we have any idea what the dollar amount is before we have to go out for public bidding so that we have some direction?
Gary, I'm going to have that for Chase tomorrow. I'll have the actual stuff. I apologize for me not knowing off the top of my head, but it changed and I don't want to give a bad number.
Thank you. That's just been an issue in the past, so I just wanted to clarify.
No, we'll have it. It's multiple numbers. You know, like I'll just use this fictitiously. $1,000 triggers this. $5,000 triggers this. $25,000 triggers this. I'm just using this as an example. That's what I'll have for him.
If we have some direction on that, that would be fantastic. Thank you.
Yep.
Regarding public notice too, I think your checklist here and what you mentioned already in the presentation was that our meetings require at least 24 hours notice. But isn't it true that our bylaws actually specify something different?
That's not a question for me.
I mean, it's okay for an organization to have a stricter policy than that.
Correct.
In other words, okay.
Absolutely. You can have a stricter policy, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
I'll just tell you that my board at Columbia River, when I was there, ours was 48 hours. That was just, the board said, look, George, we're not going to do 24, we're going to do 48. I think it was because they needed the notice.
So the 24 is just the minimum required by the state?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And if it's less than 24 and you got a true emergency, then it becomes an emergency meeting, which requires some other notices after the meeting.
Okay, great. Anybody else have any more questions? Amanda, Gary, Megan, I can see you shaking your head. Okay, Chase, do you have any questions?
I do not.
Okay.
Appreciate the
George,
time, though.
George, we thank you so much.
Hey,
I hope that was helpful to everyone.
Thank you, George.
Yep.
Thank you, George.
We appreciate it.
George and Karen, thank you very much.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
All righty then. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you, everyone. We'll see you next week at our monthly.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you, Rob, for attending. I appreciate it. Bye, everybody.
Have a good night.